You are listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 9th of February 2012 on Monocle 24. Hello, I'm Nancy Durham, and this is Midori House, live from Studio One here on Monocle 24. The failure of the United Nations to act in Homs is disastrous for the Syrian people, so says the UN Secretary General himself. We ask what's to be done as the shells continue to rain down. Monocle's Sophie Grove talks Republican Party and Tea Party with Thomas Frank, the author of Pity the Billionaire.
The reason we're in this slump in America that never seems to end is because the job creators of America are on strike.
And how to make a new airport run like a Swiss watch. At Berlin's new Brandenburg Airport, they're pretending to fly already, and it's not due for takeoff till June. We'll have these stories and more on Midori House today. First, let's get the latest news from around the world with Nick Kelly.
Monocle 24 News, I'm Nick Kelly. Tank, mortar and rocket bombardment by Syrian President Bashar al-Assad's forces on the besieged city of Homs have killed at least 110 civilians today as divided world powers struggle to find a way to end the violence. The United Nations Secretary General condemned the ferocity of the government assault on the heart of a revolt against President Assad that broke out nearly a year ago and is getting bloodier by the day. Ban Ki-moon accused the Syrian government of making too many broken promises.
I deeply regret that the Security Council has been unable to speak with one clear voice to end the bloodshed. The failure to do so is disastrous for the people of Syria.
Makeshift hospitals in besieged opposition areas of the Syrian city of Homs are overflowing with dead and wounded from government bombardments and snipers, according to a report by International Monitor Human Rights Watch. Medical supplies are running out and at least three field hospitals have been hit. Rooms are full of corpses, while in the streets, wounded people are bleeding to death as it's too dangerous for rescuers to bring them to safety. This commander deserted from government forces after being ordered to open fire on civilians.
They shoot children and they shoot men and women.
And the women.
And they try to starve the children by taking away their food and milk.
Libya has given Syria's chargé d'affaires and his staff in Tripoli 72 hours to leave the country. Libya's National Transitional Council officially recognised the Syrian Opposition Council in October as the legitimate authority in Syria. Greek political leaders clinched a long-stalled deal on reforms and austerity measures to secure a second international bailout and avoid a chaotic default hours before the country's financial backers began meeting in Brussels. European Union partners and the IMF have been exasperated by a string of broken promises and weeks of wrangling over sacrifices they demanded in return for a 130 billion euro bailout, with time running out for Greece before a major March the 20th bond redemption. Finance Minister Evangelos Venizelos set off for Brussels without a complete deal after all-night talks involving leaders of the three Greek coalition parties and chief EU and IMF inspectors left one sensitive issue, pension cuts, unresolved. The second US drone attack in 2 days in Pakistan's North Waziristan region has killed five people, including a senior militant commander with links to al-Qaeda. Intelligence officials and Pakistani Taliban sources said Badr Mansour, leader of a faction of the Pakistani Taliban with close links to al-Qaeda, was one of the five killed in the strike in Miran Shah. Spain's Supreme Court has found the human rights judge Baltasar Garzón guilty of authorising the illegal recording of defence lawyers' conversations. The unanimous ruling disbars Garzón for 11 years. He cannot appeal against the ruling. The ousted Maldivian president Mohamed Nasheed has asked the international community to act quickly to restore democracy after police issued an arrest warrant for him following what he says was a coup at gunpoint. Nasheed's supporters gathered to defend the former president. At a news conference, the Interior Minister Mohamed Jamil said that the destruction was sad and irresponsible.
It is irresponsible and it's a sad day. I would define it as the saddest day in modern history of the Maldives. Nothing warrants this scale of destruction.
Hundreds of striking police officers have agreed to leave a state assembly house they had occupied for 10 days in Brazil's third biggest city, Salvador, easing tensions in a walkout that unleashed a bloody crime wave and cast doubt on upcoming carnival celebrations across the country. There was no indication, however, the decision by 245 striking police and some family members to give up their vigil in the assembly building was a sign the strike was near an end. About 20% of the state's police's 31,000 officers walked off their jobs, resulting in a crime spree that included at least 143 murders, twice the regular homicide rate. And Bahraini activists dreaming of a return to the roundabout in Manama at the heart of a popular uprising last year have tried to recreate the electric atmosphere in a makeshift Freedom Square ahead of next week's anniversary of the unrest. Those are the top stories on Monocle 24.
Thank you, Nick. Nick Kelly with the news. And now a look at the global weather with Tomasz Szafernaker.
The weather, in association with Kuoni Travel.
And let's have a look at the areas in Europe which will be worst affected by the winter weather Thursday through Friday. Croatia, Serbia, Montenegro and other neighbouring countries. A snowstorm here, strong winds, so lots of blowing snow and daytime highs around minus 5 to minus 10 degrees, bitterly cold. In Western Europe, in the UK, fresh snowfall is expected Thursday night. Again, a possibility of disruption at a number of British airports during Friday. Here's Friday's city outlook. In London, 0 degrees, wintry morning, then afternoon sunshine. In Amsterdam, minus 2 and sunny. In Vienna, minus 7, partly cloudy. In Stockholm, it's 5 below with some sunshine. Now, North America and the rest of the week looks calm and bright, at least across most of the US and Canada. There has been a little taste of winter recently in New York City, some wintry flurries. Thursday through Friday looks sunny again. You might catch a bit of snow again in New York City come the weekend, and it'll be colder as well. Meanwhile, here's Friday's city outlook. In Boston, 8 degrees and sunshine. Washington, D.C., it's 10 on the thermometer and sunny. Vancouver, 9 and rain. San Francisco, a pleasant 15 and sunny. Other world centres now the next couple of days. In Japan, a lot of good weather, sunshine, but on the chilly side. In Tokyo, it's 7 degrees with night frosts. In South Korea and Seoul, about zero by day with sunshine. Cold nights in Seoul, minus 8 degrees. How about Hong Kong? Cloudy in 18. And down under in Sydney, showers every day and 25. That's it. I'm meteorologist Tomasz Szafernaker here on Monocle 24.
Thank you, Tomasz. Now we're just coming up to 8 minutes past the hour. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Dette Monocle 24.
Esse é Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
And Monocle 24 Tagat, yeah.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Monocle 24 is your cousin.
Tämä on Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Well, sounds from the beleaguered Syrian city of Homs today, well, the way it's starting to sound every day. The failure of the United Nations to act is disastrous for the people of Syria. Words spoken by the UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon himself. He's called the firing on civilians in Homs an appalling brutality. Syria continues to deny attacking its own people. Well, Julian Barnes-Dacey of the European Council on Foreign Relations is closely watching Syria, and he joins us on the line now from his office in London, so not next door to Syria. But thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
We are seeing and hearing with our ears every day that the situation is truly disastrous. Where does the United Nations go from here?
Well, frankly, there are very few options on the table. I mean, the fact that they were unable to reach any consensus and that really there seems to be a complete standstill of progress there suggests that actually there is very little room to maneuver on the front of the United Nations. I think it's far more likely that we are going to see a group of countries trying to push a collective diplomatic front where they can get consensus rather than trying to get support from the Chinese and the Russians.
That sounds a bit like Hillary Clinton's idea of a group of friends.
I think, I mean, something along those lines, yes. I think it's important to do that. However, I mean, the honest truth is that without Russian involvement, without Chinese involvement, it would achieve very little. They need to get some form of consensus, and I think perhaps even just by doing it away from the UN, which of course has become such a controversial location in terms of the precedent it sets for intervening in domestic affairs, maybe they can try and get Russian support there. But of course, the second thing is, even if you do get this diplomatic consensus, is it really going to make a difference on the ground? I think it's clear that the Assad regime is prepared to fight to the death to quell this repression. And really, unless you're looking at foreign intervention, is this really going to make a difference?
Well, let's look at that Assad regime. I was reading your interesting essay from a month ago when you observed that Assad was a lot stronger than many people give him credit for. And you also pointed out that we needed to see some high-level defections. Is there any sign over the past few weeks that there is a change at all in his strength?
It's clear that he's on the back foot, but he's not weak enough yet that he will go quietly into the night. And I think the fact that there have been no serious defections, the fact that the security apparatus remains remarkably cohesive, suggests really that he has a substantial power base behind him still. And again, I mean, what we are seeing in Homs today is more a picture, a reflection of an Assad regime that is going on the offensive against the opposition movement in Homs than vice versa. So I think really without some kind of dynamic that will change the balance of power, really it's hard to see any immediate prospect of Assad falling.
You were pretty dismissive of what the UN can pull off at the top of this interview, but you know we are hearing that the UN, the Arab League, are looking at another observer mission. Do you give it any kind of chance?
I think the observer mission would be a very positive step. I mean, it was condemned widely the last time it happened, but at minimum, it helped to keep levels of violence down. So I don't think the Arab League monitoring mission will achieve anything substantial in terms of brokering a solution and ending the conflict. But I think the regime is much more cautious, much more wary of keeping levels of violence lower when you have those monitors there. So I'm very much in favor of them simply as a means of trying to quell the violence we're seeing today.
Where do you think things are? It's a bit like looking into the looking glass, isn't it, somehow, or a crystal ball. Where do you think we are headed then today? 11 months, this conflict really began with a protest nearly a year ago. And
sure. I mean, the outlook is very pessimistic. I think unless someone is prepared to get in the middle, unless both sides are prepared to sit down around a negotiating table, it seems really we're looking at an inevitable slide towards civil war. I think that external foreign actors are very likely to start arming the Free Syrian Army. I think that we can expect escalating violence from the both sides. And really, it's a country that is riddled by communal differences. And the picture of Iraq, of course, haunts us and is one that may well be applicable to Syria in terms of the level of violence and the state collapse that might be upon us soon.
Do you think there is any case for intervention?
I'm not convinced that intervention would make the situation better, so no. I think intervention would hasten that move towards militarization. I think it would turn into a regional conflict, and so I don't think that would help the situation. My view is that the international community, including Russia, needs to get in the middle and to try and broker some kind of a negotiated solution, even if that doesn't result in Assad leaving power now or tomorrow, because there needs to be an end of the bloodshed. I think that's the number one priority.
But to do that, we really have to find somebody, as you keep saying, within Russia, China, or both, to help make that happen. Do we not?
Precisely. I mean, I think that's exactly what's needed. There needs to be a coming together of those countries, of Europe, of the U.S., of Turkey, and really with a committed agenda that they will seek out a political solution to this conflict. And for the moment, we have not seen that. We've very understandably seen countries backing the opposition, calling on Assad to step down. And in a sense, while that is commendable, it's not helping to resolve the situation. And I think until perhaps there is some willingness to engage with this Russian proposal of negotiation to get them in a room with Assad and with the opposition, we're really looking at kind of zero-sum ambitions from both sides that will only fuel a further militarization of the conflict.
And another bad day for the UN. If you just stand back, it feels like we've been here before. again and again.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, it reflects very badly on their ability to get in the middle of these devastating conflicts and to stop them from escalating.
Julian Barnes-Dacey of the European Council on Foreign Relations, thank you very much.
Thank you.
On the Monocle Daily at 2200 hours London time, we're going to continue our day of Arab Spring updates by looking at the increasingly unstable situation in Libya. Now let's have a song. This is Kindness. There's a good word after that interview. And the song is Swingin' Party.
At the swingin' party down the line. At the swingin'.
That was Kindness, a new band, and I'd like to know more about them or him. And the song was Swingin' Party. In just a moment on Midori House, how to test an airport before it opens to make sure there are no glitches on the day, right after this.
For the latest Monocle news, previews on upcoming films, glimpses of the new issue, and the inside scoop of all of our retail ventures and new products, you need to do one simple thing. Subscribe to the free Monocle Bulletin. Sign up now at monocle.com.
Wake up in Europe to The Globalist, live every weekday at 6 a.m. London time, here on Monocle 24.
And you're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Nancy Durham. New airport, no snags. That's the way they want it when Berlin's Brandenburg Airport opens this June. Like everyone across the world, the Germans saw what happened in the first days of Heathrow's notorious, though now glorious, Terminal 5, and they want none of that in Berlin. So right now, the workers and volunteers are pretending they're operating a real airport to make sure they get it right. On the line from Berlin right now is the airport spokesman, Ralf Kunkel. Good evening.
Hello, good evening.
Good evening to you. Now, when you are doing these tests at the airport, does it feel like it's a real airport up and running?
Almost, yes. We have about 250 airport testers in the terminal, and it really looks like a real airport, except one difference. They all have to wear helmets and Wellington boots because the construction works are still underway.
Excellent. But do they show up with suitcases and check in for flights and things like that?
That's right. They have to check in for flights. They have to do all the boarding procedures. They have to pass through the security controls and all the normal things that you have to do at an airport. There's simply one thing we cannot test, and that's the landing and starting of planes.
But everything else?
But everything else, absolutely right.
So tell us, this is, it's wonderful to have this opportunity to be able to do this. What weaknesses have you found so far and been able to start to tackle, for instance?
Well, an airport is a very complex system. You have a baggage system, you have a lot of processes, over 500 processes, 20,000 people who will work there. And of course, everybody has to find where he will work. He has to learn how all the computers do work. And that is very, very complex. And there is only one thing that will help us reducing the problems after the opening, and that's testing, testing, testing.
Okay, let's give some fair dues to Heathrow Terminal 5, because they had people running around pretending they were going to be traveling in and out of Terminal 5, didn't they? And it just was chaotic, not just on the day, but for the first weeks.
Yeah, that is right. It was not one big problem that led to this chaos in Heathrow, but they had a lot of very, very small problems that ended up in this total mess at the end of the day. And the central learning from Heathrow is that we have to take almost everything serious. Two examples. Some of the guys who worked at Heathrow Airport didn't have the right parking tickets, so they came too late to do the job. Or others had to wait too long at the security check-in controls, so they also came too late to the work. And there were too many passengers trying to get rid of the suitcases, but there was no one who could help them. And at the end of the day, all the suitcases, all the luggage had to be sent to Italy in order to be sorted there. We want to avoid such a scenario. Everybody who will work at the new airport has to be part of our test runs before the opening. Ideally, he has to work for 3 or 4 days in advance. We are on a good way, and we hope we can handle it a bit better than the colleagues in Heathrow.
Did you go to Terminal 5, or did they come to you to share knowledge?
Yes, absolutely. We're very grateful that the colleagues from Heathrow Airport were so open and supportive, and the colleagues who are responsible at my airport learned a lot of their mistakes. So in some respect, the opening of Terminal 5 was the best trial phase for our airport.
And, okay, it's not June yet. You've got months to go. How can you be sure when you open that it's going to work? Is there any way?
You can never be sure. There is only one way. You have to test all the different systems with as much people as possible. It is no question that problems will occur, but you have to have a backfall scenario, or even better, 2 or 3 backfall scenarios. So if one computer goes down, for example, you have to have a second one. For example, the whole baggage claim system, the whole baggage system is completely redundant. We have 2 different belt systems, so if one of them breaks down, we still have a second one. So we have to take into account that technical problems might occur, that some of the people still are not yet familiar with their new jobs, and that they make more mistakes than they would do normally. And in the end, the passengers aren't familiar with the airport, and so they have more questions, or they even get lost because they simply cannot find their gate.
Well, this is, I'm wondering if there's a whole new industry developing here where, you know, consultants who have expertise in starting airports.
Yes, we're quite happy that not only the colleagues from Heathrow Airport are very supportive, the colleagues from Munich Airport do help us as well. They resettled their airport in 1992, and since that time they travel all around the world and help airport companies when they resettle airports or open new airports. And so these guys are pretty experienced, and that makes us help to have a good feeling for the opening. And I think it is not exaggerated to say that it will be a good opening. I'm quite sure of that.
With all this work you're putting into it, it ought to be, really. Let me just back up a little bit. For all of us who travel and fly all around Europe, there's lots of connecting flights in and out of Frankfurt, Munich. How is this new airport, Brandenburg, Berlin-Brandenburg, going to change the way we're traveling around Europe? Is it going to make a big difference to our flights, to our connections?
I think so. Maybe not immediately after beginning, but within the next years. I'm quite optimistic that this new airport will become one of the top 10 European airports. Momentarily, we only have 2 bigger airports in Germany, Munich Airport and Frankfurt Airport, as you already mentioned. And in the future, we will have 3 airports in Germany that are very, very important and have hub structures so that you have a lot of transfer passengers there. It is one of the few airports on the European continent that is right in the heart of the continent. If you take a look at London or Paris, they are far in the west of the continent, and so it is quite likely that we will have very good connections to Asia, to the Indian market as well, because flight times are 1 hour shorter.
Fantastic. So, that's always welcome, isn't it, to the travelers? Thank you so much for this, Ralf Kunkel at Berlin-Brandenburg Airport, for joining us tonight.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Bye-bye. Now I have a song for you. It's The XX with Islands.
And I am yours now. So now I don't ever have to leave.
That was The XX and Islands. In our second half hour, we'll check in with Monocle design editor Hugo MacDonald, who's at the Stockholm Furniture Fair. We're also going to hear about the consequences of the Brazilian police strike in Salvador. But first, here's the news with Nick Kelly.
Thanks, Nancy. Tank, mortar and rocket bombardment by Syrian President Bashar al-Assad's forces on the besieged city of Homs have killed at least 110 civilians today as divided world powers struggle to find a way to end the violence. Greek political leaders clinched a long-stalled deal on reforms and austerity measures to secure a second international bailout and avoid a chaotic default hours before the country's financial backers began meeting in Brussels. The second US drone attack in 2 days in Pakistan's North Waziristan region has killed 5 people, including a senior militant commander with links to al-Qaeda. Spain's Supreme Court has found the human rights judge Baltasar Garzón guilty of authorising the illegal recording of defence lawyers' conversations. And he will be jailed for 11 years for that. The former president of the Indian Ocean Archipelago of the Maldives awaited arrest in his house today, vowed to stay and fight against the government he says ousted him in a coup with the connivance of the police and military. Hundreds of striking police officers have agreed to leave a state assembly house they had occupied for 10 days in Brazil's third biggest city, Salvador, easing tensions in a walkout that unleashed a bloody crime wave and cast doubt on the forthcoming carnival celebrations across the country. The American Vice President Joe Biden and a group of human rights advocates have discussed the deterioration of the rights situation in China, the White House said today, signalling the issue is likely to figure in his talks with China's vice president next week. And Bahraini activists, dreaming of a return to the roundabout in Manama at the heart of a popular uprising last year, have tried to recreate the electric atmosphere in a makeshift Freedom Square ahead of next week's anniversary of the unrest. Those are the top stories here on Monocle 24.
Nearly 200 Brazilian police officers in the northeast state of Bahia ended their 10-day occupation of a state assembly building today. Police are striking for better working conditions and increased salaries. Since 10,000 officers went on strike, Brazilians living in the area have faced a huge increase in violent crime. One of the cities hit is Salvador, which will host tens of thousands of tourists for carnival celebrations next week. We've reached Joe Leahy, the Financial Times bureau chief in Sao Paulo. Good evening.
Good evening.
It sounds pretty scary there. What's the situation like?
Well, the situation in Salvador over the past week or more has been very tense. People have been staying off the streets and avoiding the centre. And we saw also a travel warning from the US to its citizens to avoid Salvador while this strike was ongoing because of. The large incidents of violent crime. In fact, we saw at least 143 murders during this period, which is twice the normal murder rate for Salvador, which is already very high. So I think you could safely describe it as a fairly tense situation over there.
Are gangs and thugs just taking the opportunity to steal, kill for some reason or other?
It's a mixture of that. That state already has quite a high crime rate, I should say homicide rate, around about 55 per 100,000 people, which I think compares to around 6.5 for New York. So it's already a state that has an issue with law and order. It's partly because these northeastern states of Brazil are booming. They're sometimes called the China of Brazil in terms of their economic growth rate. And accompanying this growth has been a rise in crime as well. So once you take the police off the streets, you obviously get a rise in crime. Also, there's some suspicion that some of these police who have been on strike may also have been involved in some of these crimes.
Oh, that's not too helpful. Joe, the situation also appears to be kind of confusing. We've been following the wires here, and we were hearing that the police left that building they were occupying today, and for a moment it looked as if the strike might be ending. Is there any way there is a negotiation going on and that the end might be in sight?
Yes, yeah. My understanding was that the strike was coming to an end after they left the building. That was obviously the most sort of dramatic part of the strike. They are negotiating now over salaries, and of course salaries of police and even firemen in Brazil are considered low. And these are people who are, as we just described, facing very dangerous situations on the streets, and people do sympathise with them. But getting wage increases in Brazil for across such huge forces of police is quite difficult.
So when they're striking over that, you've mentioned the low pay, and I guess the conditions, it's obvious. They're doing extremely dangerous work, and they've got to be targets. Is that their chief complaint, that the kind of atmosphere they're working in?
It's more to do with the slow pace of way, from their point of view, the slow pace of salary increases. In Brazil this year, we saw a 14% increase in the minimum wage, and they are being offered a 6.5% increase in salary. So they obviously believe that they should be getting a much higher increase. Plus, they're seeing all around them, as I said, in these states, they're seeing enormous economic growth, and obviously they feel as though they're being left behind.
Okay. The other event that comes to mind, of course, is the World Cup. Football is headed your way in 2014, followed by the Olympics a couple of years later. So these kinds of a strike like this and on this scale has got to be really bad publicity for the country.
Yes, this highlights some of the law and order issues that do lurk below the surface. And it's no secret to the Brazilian government that this exists. They've been trying to clear some of the favelas in Rio of the armed gangs. They've had some success, and in Salvador they're starting to work on the problem. It is a big problem, law and order, and as soon as you take the police off the streets, you see what happens. So I think for the Brazilian government, this is going to be a major thing that they have to come to terms with ahead of the games, the World Cup in particular, because the World Cup is not only going to be in Rio, it's going to be across the country. So every city is going to have to make sure that they make an extra effort to try and clean up these sorts of problems.
Thank you so much for joining us tonight.
A pleasure.
Bye-bye.
Thanks very much.
Thank you. Bye. Joe Leahy, Financial Times Bureau Chief in Sao Paulo, Brazil. Let's hear a song by Annie, Me Plus One. That was Annie with Me Plus One. The Republican Party and the Tea Party. Sophie Grove has an interview after this.
The Briefing is Monocle 24's fast-paced current affairs hour at midday London time. We review the American front pages fresh off the press, check in on the stories unfolding in Europe, and round up the events at the end of the day in Asia.
Who is the true conservative? This is the question voters in primaries are going to have to be asking themselves.
Wake up in New York to The Briefing, live every weekday at midday London time.
As the results of the Republican primaries continue to make news in the United States, Thomas Frank's new book, Pity the Billionaire, looks at the rebirth of right-wing populism. Earlier, Monocle's senior editor Sophie Grove spoke with Thomas Frank about Obama, the Republican candidates, and she asked if anyone does pity the billionaire.
Of course, nobody really pities the billionaire, but it's not a huge exaggeration. Although they're not specifically talking about billionaires, there's this term that the conservative movement likes to use, job creators. Have you heard this term? Job creators. This is who, you're supposed to really bow down to in America, and you're supposed to do every last little thing that they want, right, in terms of legislation and policy and that kind of thing. You're supposed to please the job creators, and you're especially supposed to stop saying mean things about the job creators. And there's Speaker John Boehner, about 3 months ago, gave a speech. This is, the Republican leader in the House of Representatives in America, gave a speech where he said that the reason we're in this slump in America that never seems to end is because the job creators of America are on strike. And you know why they're on strike? Because we've been, you know, disrespecting them. So you...
Is this anything new? I mean, your book is about this sort of utopian capitalism that is gripping the US at the moment. But I mean, in the US, people have always been very happy with, you know, a minority getting very rich, and the meritocratic values of the US have always allowed that to happen. How is it different at the moment?
Every pundit in America in 2008 was, you know, looked out at the sort of this landscape of economic wreckage and said, you know, the economic direction we've been on for 30 years, which is this sort of conservative, deregulatory, you know, direction. You've been doing the same thing in Britain as well. But every pundit in America said, well, this has come to an end. This has now sort of met its, you know, this is how it's wound up. And the country has to change direction. The Republican Party has to move back to the center. You know, conservatism's day has come and gone. And what the Republican Party did instead was they purged their moderates. They sort of committed themselves to an even purer version of the sort of economic dogmas of the last 30 years. And they were successful. They won this sort of triumphant sweeping election in 2010. And so it's, you know, for them, polarization not only continues to go on, but it's been you know, validated by history. They won, you know, they polarized and they won.
And what about the Republican audience? I mean, is there something, I mean, in your book, do you look at the fact that so many of the Republican voters are blue collar workers, and that kind of irrational sense that they're voting for these amazingly rich people? And is that something yeah. about the American dream? How does that happen? You're talking about these sort of utopian capitalism. It sounds like a religion.
It is. It's very similar. I actually saw the funniest damn thing just the other day. You know, each of these candidates running for the president in the Republican Party right now, they're having their primaries. They've got this billionaire behind them, right? Newt Gingrich has his billionaire. It's this casino mogul. Rick Santorum has his billionaire. And Romney, of course, is well, not quite. He's a quarter billionaire, but he's got his friends, right? And the billionaire behind Rick Santorum said something really interesting. It was commenting about how you need to have this blue collar guy running for the presidency, and you know, it was a really peculiar thing. But it was just taken for granted that blue collarness is an act that you do in politics. It's something that you put on in order to win over a certain kind of voter. And the way they speak about this kind of voter, it's not like, say, people who are worried about the minimum wage, or people who are worried about healthcare, or people who are worried about their wages or something like that. It's people who are worried about authentic Americanness, you know? That's what moves blue-collar voters in this way of looking at things. And look, the other thing you mentioned, this kind of utopian vision of capitalism, at the end of the day, this can be made into, and in fact is made into, a very, you know, powerful appeal. It might sound stupid the way I describe it, because I'm going out of my way to make it look stupid. But if you're in America just watching the TV commercials and seeing the people protesting down in the park and waving their signs and being all angry about things, this seems like a pretty good way to protest against the sort of obvious disasters of 2008-2009, you know, the financial crisis and the bailouts, and these guys in the Tea Party movement with their utopian capitalism. And that really is what it is. But they are out there. They're the only ones out there denouncing this stuff.
And who are the culprits? I mean, your book is dedicated to a few commentators, sort of journalists, if you can call them that, who are whipping people up and sort of creating this atmosphere and propelling the Tea Party movement.
Yeah.
Who are the real ones to watch, and who are the worst?
Well, the my favorite, I don't know if you'd say he's the worst, but my favorite was this guy Glenn Beck, who was a Fox News commentator or anchorman, or I don't know what you'd call him. It's a cross between a newsreader and an entertainer, right? So he talks about the news of the day, but constantly you know, throws jokes in there and then goes on and tells anecdotes, and everything has a very powerful political slant. So it's not really a news show. It's like a commentary show. And he was able to make this appeal to this kind of utopian capitalism. and make it seem like a real populist movement, a movement that had something in it for everyone. He tries to sort of his object is to persuade you that the end of the world is right around the corner. You know, doom is coming. And it's just it's always coming in some way other than the obvious one. Right. The obvious one is the economy is in the toilet. Right. The economy is ruined. Everything is a disaster. But he was always coming up with these other things like your basic liberties are under siege. Or there's hyperinflation is coming. This is a favorite on the right.
Out of the Republican candidates, we've got a mixture of kind of libertarians. There are a few near billionaires in there. Who do you see as emerging as the most sort of stable, viable opposition leader, if any?
They haven't really had any great leaders arise out of the Tea Party movement. I mean, you'll probably see that in a year or two. The guy who struck me as being the obvious presidential candidate for them was Mitt Romney. And I've only seen him speak once, but he struck me as a very accomplished politician. You know, he sort of mimics the Reagan manner. He does a really good job of it. But he is running into all kinds of trouble, as you've noticed, as you follow the news, because you've got these other, Rick Santorum and Newt Gingrich. I don't, both of those guys have terrible problems. I don't think either one of them is really electable as president.
And finally, I wanted to ask you, we've looked at the right, and I wondered, there has been quite a lot of talk about increasing tax for the super rich. And is there a movement to counter the far right? Is there a sort of social redistribution of wealth? Is there a sort of lobby that is going to be pushing for that?
You look at a guy like Barack Obama, who's very, not only their leader, but is also very typical of the sort of what liberalism is in America nowadays. He's very uncomfortable with discontent. Not only does he not organize discontent, he does everything he can to tamp down discontent. It's not something that he understands. It's not something that he's comfortable around. And this is true of Democrats generally. And so they really missed the moment. Just in the last couple of months, you've seen this Occupy Wall Street movement spring up. But so far, it's just barely begun. It's got a long way to go until it actually starts, politicians start paying it heed, if that ever happens.
Monocle's Sophie Grove talking with Thomas Frank, author of Pity the Billionaire.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Dette Monocle 24.
Essa Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
En Monocle 24 har vært, ja.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Monocle 24 er jo også.
Tämä on Monaco 24.
The Propa Jalavet, Monaco 24.
Esto es Monaco 24.
After the Monaco 24.
The head at Monaco 24.
This is Monaco 24.
This is Monaco 24.
This is Monaco 24.
You're listening to Monaco 24.
This is Monaco 24.
Monocle design editor Hugo MacDonald is in Stockholm checking out the furniture at the fair, the biggest in Scandinavia, but also reputedly the coziest one on the circuit, I'm told. Hugo's on the line from the fair now. Hi, Hugo.
Hello, Nancy.
I trust you're sitting in a fabulously well-designed chair or standing near one.
I'm actually huddling in a corner of the fairground where it's the only place that doesn't have music playing and it doesn't have people doing business in the background. So not much atmospheric sound of the fair here.
But you've seen some fabulous four-legged creatures to sit on there, have you?
I have. Gosh, I've seen enough to last a lifetime, actually. There's certainly no shortage of chairs here. But actually, some of the most interesting things isn't the furniture. It's the concept has been done by the students. And the thing that always strikes me coming to Stockholm is the sheer quality of the Scandinavian design schools. And each of the schools comes and shows its final year project as part of the fair. And really that's the big thing of hope in this market, is that there are so many young, talented people with not just brilliant ideas, but also brilliant skill. They can build a chair, but they can also think about designs that might improve living in the future.
Could you paint us a picture or two of something unusual or refreshing you've spotted?
There's a school called Konstfack, which is based in Stockholm itself, and they've done a wonderful project investigating how hydroponics can aid everyday life. And they've incorporated hydroponic ideas into kitchens, waste disposal, houses, how they can be heated more effectively. And these are very sort of high concept ideas, but they've all been delivered very beautifully and very practically. And I mean, this is things that you really don't see mainstream designers really attempting to address. So to see students do it, tackle it, and do it so well is really quite astounding.
Well, from that sort of upbeat note, I understand you're really frustrated with some of the messages you're hearing. Tell us about the Polish man you found who's looking for Swedish companies to send their production line to China.
Exactly. Well, this was one of the most surprising people that I've met, actually, since I've been here. He's a Polish man who has a company that he distributes furniture that's made in China to the contract market in Europe. And first of all, I spent the whole morning looking around the fair, talking to manufacturers, and lots of Swedish manufacturers, obviously. They say that their business is doing badly because they can't cope with the big influx of very cheap knockoff furniture that's coming from China and from Eastern Europe. And so then quite by chance, I met this Polish man who had one of these companies that was responsible for this huge influx. And I started off by asking him, you know, do you not have any of conscience or sense of remorse when you come to a fair like this and you see these huge historic Swedish, Danish, Finnish manufacturers who are really struggling to compete against the likes of you? And he said, well, you know, no, somebody got to do it because it's happening and it's just an opportunity to make money. So I said, well, what are you actually doing here at the fair? And he said, I'm going to a lot of these old manufacturers and saying, you're in difficulty, maybe you could turn your business around if I put you in touch with a Chinese manufacturer who could make all your furniture for much cheaper and you could sell it for a cheaper price.
Wow.
So effectively, he's sort of stealing the design heritage and the manufacturing that is at the heart of so many of these communities in Scandinavia.
And what's the reaction to this there? I mean, are Swedes upset?
Yes, they are. I mean, they're sort of caught between a rock and a hard place, really, because they have these age-old businesses that are really, really struggling in this financial climate. But at the heart of their core identity is craft and tradition and supporting local communities. They don't want to lay off all their staff and start outsourcing their production. It really is a last resort. But when you have somebody who's going around and sort of hounding business and saying, you know, you won't be here in 5 years' time unless you take up the offer of someone like me, then it sort of makes the whole business very murky and slightly ugly.
You know, Hugo, Jonathan Openshaw was in here the other day talking about a new word, reshoring, and it's bringing businesses back home in the States, in Europe, where whichever country. And it's at odds with what you're talking about, but other businesses are finding that it actually isn't so cheap anymore. Wages are higher in China, the cost of fuel is higher, all of that. So it's a bit odd to be hearing this at this particular moment.
No, you're quite right. And I mean, it's beginning to happen in the design world as well. But this is a big problem, I think, is the fact that the furniture that is made by these Swedish companies is very, very expensive.
And why is that? Why is that?
It's just because it's investing in skills that very few people have. And you can only make, say, 200 chairs in this way when every piece is made by hand. You're having to import materials. You're having to pay very few staff but very well to make this furniture. Only a few people can really afford it. It's not mass market furniture. And young people in Sweden, young people throughout Scandinavia simply can't afford to buy this furniture. So instead they do look to buy the slightly cheaper furniture that it doesn't have to be made in China, but it's maybe using sort of manufacturers in Poland instead who have taken quite a lot of the manufacturing weight out of Scandinavia. But, I mean, you're right. When it comes to logistics and things, it's difficult to, you know, it's not the great big cash cow that it once was to have everything made in China and then shipped over here and sold. But furniture is a slightly tricky industry in that
beautifully
made furniture is very expensive and there just aren't that many people who can afford it nowadays.
Sorry to jump in there. I just thought we have time for one more, maybe a little bit along the same line, but I was interested in your observation that a lot of the designs, as beautiful as they are, when you look around the hotels and public places, are very samey because the same sort of firm is getting all the jobs. What's that about?
Exactly. And, well, I mean, this also has something to do with the economy, where new businesses, be it restaurants, hotels, shops, they open and they don't really want to take too many risks with the way that they're designed. They see that the shop down the road that opened 3 years ago was designed by one particular firm and it's done very well, and they think, well, if we employ those designers, then at least we know we can't go too far wrong. And so what happens is within 5 years, one firm has designed 30 places throughout the city, and suddenly walking around, be it going to a bar or a restaurant or a cafe or a shop, staying in a hotel, you see the same style and the same furniture in every place. And this is something that has happened throughout Europe. Wherever there is a sort of design hub, there's always one firm that's right at the top. In Sweden, it's called Klaisen Koivistoruna, and they are a trio of fantastic designers who are incredibly prolific. But at the same time, I can't help but feel walking around Stockholm that it's beginning to feel a little bit stagnant, and everything does look the same.
Well, on that note, I better let you go and have some coffee and a hot dog. I hear that's what everybody does out there to keep warm.
Yes, exactly. It's freezing, it's snowing, and it's minus six.
But, well, thank you very much for taking a moment away from this fascinating show to talk with us.
Not at all. Thank you, Nancy.
Thank you. See you soon. Hugo MacDonald, Monocle's design editor.
Están escuchando Monocle 24.
Dobro pozdravljavat, Monocle 24.
Esse é Monocle 24.
Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
Det här är Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
That's it for the Thursday edition of Midori House. Today's show was produced by Marcus Hippie, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and our studio manager was Andrew Carter. The Monocle Daily is coming up in 3 hours at 2200 London time. There we'll be continuing our day of Arab Spring updates by looking at the increasingly unstable situation in Libya. We also have a studio debate on the future of the high street. But first, stay tuned for The Urbanist right after the news headlines here on Monocle 24. I'm Nancy Durham. Bye-bye.